Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Welcome. We have two petition hearings today. One, a revisit, and the second, no. The first is Rules Petition 0901, public hearing in the matter of the amendment of WISSTAT Sections 80210, 80401, 80408, 80409, 80412, 80507, generally can be under the category electronic discovery. On July 6th, the court issued an order adopting amendments to the statutes relating to the discovery of electronically stored information. We adopted them, and we made one change which related to meet and confer. And it was ordered at that time that these amendments would go into effect on January 1, 2011, but that the court would have another hearing giving people an opportunity to comment. And this is that second hearing. And we have as appearances Tim Edwards, John Mitby, and John Sankovitz. Tim Edwards and John Mitby, both of Axley Brinnison, did have written comments on these issues previously, and Judge Sankovitz appeared before the court and has sent in comments. So we're going to hear from Mr. Edwards first. Attorney Edwards.
Good morning, and may it please the court. It is a privilege to be here today. My name is Tim Edwards, and I am here with John Mitby. I will be presenting briefly, and Mr. Mitby will not be presenting. We've obviously discussed the information that we want to share with the court. I was thinking about electronic discovery, which is something that I'm involved in quite a bit. And, you know, three things come to mind right away. One is that it's very, very important in terms of the development and the discovery of admissible evidence is in electronic form in so many cases today. It's also very complicated because of the IT issues that come up in the e-discovery context. And I think as these rules recognize, it can be very expensive. And dealing with all of that, I think, is very difficult because of the balancing that needs to be done. I think that the Judicial Council has done an excellent job of balancing these different, even competing considerations, and put together a set of rules that will serve well for the state of Wisconsin. And I think I and others should acknowledge their hard work because it's easy to sit in the background and armchair quarterback what they keep putting out, but it's been excellent across the board. I'm impressed and have been impressed.
I assume you're here on the but. And it's great, but.
I was earlier, and now not so much.
Okay.
Because, go ahead, Your Honor. I'm
sorry. Well, I just wanted to say I reread your commentary and Mr. Mitby's commentary from the last round, and it was really excellent, and there's no but. You had some different views on some of the details in it. You talked about costs, for example, and crawlback and privilege, and et cetera. So what specifically, if I can ask you, you can say a number of things. One, you can say don't adopt these rules in the present form, period. Is that your position?
No.
Okay. You can say, okay, you should do some more repairs on it.
That would be my view, Your Honor.
Okay, and then I would ask you, if you might help the court if you'd state what the repairs are, and then we can go into detail on it, okay?
Okay. I think
would that help?
Yeah,
would that be okay?
That's fine. Okay. I think that's a good direction to go. I think we've outlined what those concerns are in our submission.
Right. In April or whatever date it was.
Right. And those concerns stand.
Right.
Mm-hmm. My concern has been about this hard work that's been done is whether or not we have unnecessarily reinvented the wheel. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of provisions in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that were carefully considered, and as the byproduct of a lot of thought and deliberation as has occurred here, I think that the net result was very, very good in terms of how to manage this difficult problem, understanding that you can't manage it completely because there are certain variables beyond your control. But in the middle of all of that, my first reaction was, why are we departing from some of these ideas that I think make sense?
Like what?
Cost shifting.
Okay. The answer has been, and I'm sure Joe Sankovitz will say, it's presently not specifically related to this, but there are other provisions in the code that take care of it.
And there are. That's a true statement. But as I submitted earlier, e-discovery is complicated. It's expensive. It can be a real problem. It needs to be dealt with proactively. And I think it's a specific area where we need to provide guidance to litigators about what the court will consider when you have a cost-shifting issue. And the standard that's provided right now is a balancing test that is, in my opinion, far too vague and doesn't itemize specific considerations that are unique in this context that a litigator, such as myself, could go and review and say, wait a minute, I can't do this. I have to consider whether or not the request that I've made is really directly targeted to admissible evidence, considering all the costs involved in producing this data. Where is the data? Is it accessible or isn't it? How much is this going to cost in light of the overall amount of the claim? And I know that those are things that the courts can consider, and I know that there's law from the second district in New York and other cases across the country, that kind of developed this idea of a specific e-discovery approach. But I think one of the key policy considerations for e-discovery is managing the activity of the litigants at the front end. I think that's the best way to reduce costs, assuming that the participants are involved in good faith. Right? I mean, the other variable, when you have people that are cheating and not playing fair, that there are other mechanisms to take account for. But assuming a perfect world where there's cooperation, you can provide this information up front. It can even be brought out in a meet and confer, and the parties can resolve these questions or at least understand where the result is likely to fall and make an informed decision.
I'm trying to find where in your prior comments, what do you suggest that we do in cost?
Well, there are a number of specific criteria laid out in the federal rules that I think are useful. I would recommend that maybe the commentary to the rule include a reference to some specific authority that can be invoked to provide the guidance and direction. And obviously there's the Zubilaki opinions and other opinions. There's a case out of the Eastern District of Milwaukee, the Hagedorn case, that I think adopts the Zubilaki factors. I would have a reference there so that at least the rules themselves point in the right direction.
So if I understand you, in an ideal world, you'd like us to incorporate whatever the federal rules say about costs, but that you think in a simpler form, a comment could make a reference to sources for criteria or discussion of the cost-shifting issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counselor, in the federal rules, what are the specific things that a court is directed to look at in regard to a cost-shifting motion that may be brought before the court?
One would be the, and I think this is the front-end question, is the accessibility of the data. If it's been archived somewhere and you have to recreate a program to pull it out, that's a big question. The volume of the data, what type of a mechanism you want to use to search the data, or do you want to sample the data? How do you want to go through to look for responsive information without requiring somebody to go through every single document that's contained in an archive somewhere? The ability of the party to find the information through other means, and I think, you know, kind of a cost-benefit analysis of how much is it going to cost for us to go after this information in light of the overall value of the case, or even the ultimate utility of the information that could be discovered in connection with the substance of the case itself.
Counselor, in your experience using the federal rules, how does this generally play out? How does it kind of work out? Give us a practical example, if you can, about how this works out when you're involved in litigation and the question of e-discovery arises. How is it generally worked out, either between counsel, or if counsel can't work it out, how is it presented to the court?
In an ideal setting where the parties are cooperating with one another in good mm-hmm. faith, there's not a single meet and confer. In fact, we've had cases that are complicated where we have had meet and confer sessions with opposing counsel on a weekly basis solely with respect to electronic discovery, and we argue back and forth about these factors all the time. And then ultimately, we try to come to a result. But by the time we go to the court, we've exchanged enough information so we know where everybody stands, and we're prepared to roll the dice and see what happens. I think that that's an important dialogue to have. Now, in the state system, you don't have that many, well, you have some, but you don't have that many complicated cases that would require that level of interaction. But that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is no cooperation and people are playing games and you have to do actual discovery about the discovery, where you go and you depose IT technicians and other people for the company and try to find out where the data is, whether it's been destroyed. And that creates a whole other set of problems. But yeah. I think I've addressed the question, I hope.
Yeah, I think that you did. Now, do you practice exclusively in federal court or do you practice in state court as well?
Probably 80% in federal court.
In federal court, okay.
At least right now.
All right. Have you had any e-discovery questions that have come up in your state court practice?
Yes.
And how have you, well, first of all, what kind of a case have they come up in? Do you recall?
The one that comes to mind is an employment case. I represented a gentleman that had been terminated, and we served discovery regarding preservation efforts, location of data, things like that. And in the process found out that some information was not there anymore because the company had not really implemented litigation hold properly, and we had to work through that. Other counsel was cooperative. The cost-shifting analysis worked in our favor because there was mistakes made on their part. And so they paid to retrieve the data and produce it for us. But so, I mean, we've seen it already without the rules. I mean, it's out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So they basically relied on kind of a Zublocki analysis about what you'd look at in state court.
Yeah. And I referred to that in the briefing to the court on the issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, in response to your cost shifting, when this matter was heard previously, that is, on January 21st, Judge Sankovich said, we don't need the federal rule because we have our civil rules of procedure 804.013, which gives the judges the right to address and protect parties from discovery requests that cause, quote, undue burden. And we also have, he said, 804.013A2, which gives the court authority to specify the terms upon which discovery may be had. So he continued in his comments that we already have the authority to say the requesting party this is going to be really expensive and to, and now I'm,
this is going to be expensive, and I don't think you're going to get much benefit out of it, and I don't think the responding party should bear the burden, et cetera. He also cited the court to the case of Vincent versus Vincent as a reason that we don't need to adopt the cost shifting of the federal rules. Do you have any responses to any of those three cited authorities?
I haven't read the Vincent case. With respect to the other provisions that he cites, I agree that that is the general framework. And in terms of rulemaking, I'm not an expert, and I understand that you have to draw the line between setting general standards that trial courts can apply within their discretion, and the discretion we want them to have, and specific standards that we want to use to try to regulate behavior on a more specific basis. And I'm arguing for the latter to some extent, and so, and that's why I disagree with him on this point. I think that the e-discovery issue is unknown to many lawyers. I think that I've had many conversations with attorneys where they're not attuned to this, and ultimately they're going to have to be. I think that that's also true with some of the trial courts. And I think providing direction and guidance in this area is important, and that's based on my initial assumption that if you are proactive and you load this down at the front end and get everybody involved, that with respect to e-discovery, that you're going to save resources and you are going to expedite the proceeding because people will know a little bit more what's involved.
But I go ahead.
A couple more questions, if you don't mind. How do you define electronically stored information?
Me, myself?
Or how do you think these rules contemplate what electronically stored information is?
Well, that's a question that is answered in the advisory comments to the federal rules under Rule 34, and there is an extremely broad definition, and it's basically data that's stored in any medium.
Okay, so it's a very broad definition under the federal rules.
Right. Even meant to apply to technology we do not know about yet.
Indeed. And these, the rule that this court issued in the July 6th order, that covers all types of cases. When I listened to 80% of your practice was in federal court, I thought, with respect, in my mind, sounds like a Philadelphia lawyer. By that I mean you deal with sophisticated cases, even though you're not. But, of course, I think this rule applies even to small claims cases, because small claims cases, maybe the person in the collection agency, their bills are stored electronically these days, and that's, most people do store all their stuff electronically. And other emails, obviously, by definition, are electronic. And so is it your understanding these rules would also apply not only to the big cases, not only to the federal court cases, but potentially to small claims cases also?
Not necessarily. I think that there could be exemptions for certain requirements for small claims cases or cases where the value is under a certain amount.
Mm-hmm. I mean, have you had an opportunity to review the rule that the court issued on July 6th that was sent out? That's what we're here on?
Yes, Your Honor.
Today? Okay. But there are no exceptions for small claims or anything like that in the rule. So the rule, is it your understanding that the rule as stated would also encompass all cases, including small claims cases?
As stated, yes. Mm-hmm. And I'm not necessarily sure that that's always going to be a big problem. I mean, courts can regulate and manage discovery in their discretion and obviously use resources to make sure that it doesn't spin out of control. If the responding party to a discovery request in a small claims case is doing what it should do, as it should in any case, responsive information could be produced as a matter of course.
The final question I have, and thank you for your indulgence, is with regard to the provision 804.01.4M Discovery Conference, and that's sometimes referred to as in the Judicial Council proposal and amended proposal as a discretionary conference, and sometimes referred to in the July 6th, 2010 order as a mandatory conference. And 80401-4M provides, at any time after commencement of an action on the court's own motion or the motion of a party, the court may order the parties to confer by any appropriate means, including in person, regarding any of the following, except for discovery of electronically stored information, where parties must confer unless excused by the court. How do you interpret that language?
As I see it, this language requires the parties to confer if electronically stored information or the discovery of electronically stored information is involved unless the court excuses them. I see this as a mandatory provision.
Is a conference required even if there is no motion by the court or a party's motion?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So regardless, your interpretation of that provision is regardless of whether a party makes a motion or regardless of whether the court on its own motion addresses the issue of electronic discovery, there is a mandatory conference unless excused by the court.
That's how I read the rule, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Including small claims matters.
Excuse me?
Including small claims matters.
Yes, subject to the proviso that the court could excuse it.
Counselor, this conference can occur by phone, and in fact it often does occur simply by telephone, correct?
That's true.
And if you were in a small claims matter and you decided there would be no e-discovery, the conference could last all of about 3 minutes, saying we're doing no e-discovery in this particular case, correct?
That's true.
And it would still satisfy the rule that the court has drafted, correct?
In my opinion, yes.
The only responsibility that the rule does is place an upfront obligation on the parties to first deal with the issue before they seek court intervention if they haven't gotten a satisfactory resolution to the question.
I agree with that.
Thank you.
And in small claims court, that ordinarily would be, or could be, a plaintiff who's representing himself or
right.
herself.
Okay. Right.
All right. We've talked about cost shifting. We've talked about, how do you feel about meet and confer? Do you want it mandatory?
Yes.
I thought that was what your letter would indicate. Okay, so the draft as presently stands is okay with you as to meet and confer.
Assuming that my interpretation of the draft is correct.
Okay. All right. What other issues do you want improved in this draft?
One of the, I think, more difficult questions that comes up is how to deal with privileged information that's inadvertently disclosed. And I know that
that's the clawback, right?
The clawback issue. I'm not sure that the common law of waiver is going to necessarily provide us with the guidance that we need. And the reason why is we're dealing with a unique set of evidence at times in these cases where there's just so much of it. Something is going to be disclosed that shouldn't be, and there should be a mechanism for dealing with it. Now, my hope in a perfect world would be that this would be dealt with at the meet and confer at the front end, that there would be a protective order put in place. This is assuming it's a fairly complex matter, and that the protective order would address the need for a clawback, and that the parties could deal with the issue proactively, because that saves money and time down the road. But at the end of the day, I think that the issue should be addressed more directly in terms of making that available and providing for an immediate return of inadvertently disclosed information.
Judge Stankovic's response, if I remember it correctly, is that the issue of privileges being dealt with separately by the Judicial Council under 502.
Right. And that may be an effective way of dealing with it, Your Honor.
So if that's the way it dealt with, it can be dealt separately.
I believe so.
Okay.
Counselor,
Is that just a reminder then to us that keep our eyes on this and that make sure that it's dealt with?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Counselor, does the federal rules provision of a clawback have any impact at all on preventing malpractice actions against lawyers who inadvertently disclose confidential information?
Well, I think it's one piece of an argument in support of the idea that there is not malpractice in that context. It's not an excuse for letting, you know, the cow out of the barn, so to speak, in Wisconsin.
But it is a recognition that the court has acknowledged that to do so is something that may occur during the course of electronic discovery, and that's why there's a written-in remedy for that kind of a disclosure.
I would agree with that.
Thank you.
This can happen in other forms.
It can.
In fact, wasn't it a case that we had that large volumes of documents came to a party, and there were documents in there that should not have been released? So it's a general provision. So whatever we did on clawback should cover more than electronic discovery.
I would agree with that.
All right, what I'm trying to focus on is these rules are going to go into effect on January 2011 unless we change them now, because there's still time.
Right.
So what I'm trying to focus is what do you want changed so that it will go into effect in 2011? Because you've said these rules are better than nothing, if I understood you right. As they now stand, they're better than not having any rules.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So you favor them going into effect, but you want them changed. So I'm trying to focus on what should the court do today to repair defects that you see?
Let me answer that in a general sense, and this is just more of a global reaction to your question. But And maybe this is because I'm a Philadelphia lawyer. I don't know. But I work with the federal rules quite a bit, and I'm accustomed to them, and so I may have some bias. But I did practice law in state court quite a bit before this. And it seems to me that, and we've said this before, and it seems to me there's a missed opportunity here. And the reason why I say that is because the federal rules have been developed with careful thought, and I think that they cover this topic very well. And to be critical, I would say that I don't understand why we have decided to pick and choose and reinvent a wheel that is working for the most part. And the benefit to adopting the federal rules is obvious. There is a world of case law out there that we can start to use to help us understand how the courts are dealing with these situations and to provide guidance to the trial courts on some of these very difficult questions.
So, in sum, you just would like us to adopt the federal rules?
Well, yes.
Okay.
It's a lot easier.
Okay.
And all of my colleagues
Without
in Philadelphia agree with that, by the way.
They have to take the bar, but we're going to deal with that in the next round.
You want to hear my thoughts on that?
Not.
No, thank you.
Okay. So if I understand where you are, you want us to add something in regard to cost shifting, particularizing what things a trial court should consider, because the things that will be considered in a cost-shifting analysis for e-discovery are different than those things that might be considered in a motion on a protective order for a deposition or something like that.
That's true.
And you want us to include an obligation to look at this cost-shifting stuff in the mandatory conference that we've already enacted in the rules.
Yes.
And you think clawback would be a good idea because waiver isn't really sufficient in providing volumes of discovery such as you do with electronic discovery, and so it will be helpful to have a mechanism already set out in the rules that the courts are comfortable applying.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no additional questions.
I just want to say, I don't have a question, but I do want to say that on rereading yours and Mr. Mitby's commentary, you had some very thoughtful and excellent suggestions on revisions, in effect, moving away from dealing with electronic discovery of documents or informational records, which is another issue you raised, to treating electronic discovery as any kind, discovery of any kind of material. And I thought that was very interesting, and I want to say thank you.
Well, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Mitby. You waive your right? Okay. Thank you. It's good seeing. Okay. By telephone? The microphone might not have picked that up, but the next speaker was going to be John Mitby. But he has deferred to the comments made. Thank you for coming, and my comments about your materials that you sent earlier stands for you too, Mr. Mitby. Before I call on Judge Sankovitz, is there anyone else here who wishes to appear on 0901? Would you please approach the podium? Could you state your name, please?
May it please the Court, I'm Sarah Zylstra. I'm a private practitioner at Boardman Law Firm. My comments today are few, in part because I cannot say that I have any answer to e-discovery. I applaud the Court's efforts to try and figure out the best way to address it. In all my dealings with private practitioners, I hear the same thing, which is, I won't do what I did last time every time I get a large document e-discovery case. It's a learning process on how to handle it from a private practitioner's point of view, both in terms of production and receiving. I will say that I am very happy with the advent of e-discovery that I practice in Madison, Wisconsin, because the only way e-discovery works is if you have reasonable attorneys on both sides of the V, so to speak. I will say that in most cases, we don't really follow the rules. We agree amongst each other what we can do, what we can't do, and how to do it. And it's different for every case. Some cases, and I think the volume is really the difficult aspect of it. I've spent the last 3 weeks reviewing 6,817 emails of a client for a case that I have. I'm reviewing them for privilege, and also clients often put things in emails that are multi-topics. So, for example, we'll take a case that I'm where there's a bank and it's a loan, and the issue is you have issues with whether or not the loan was properly managed. Administrators and businesses will often sit there in emails and write things like, well, on this loan, we really should be doing A, B, and C. That's something that the other side should know, that this was the internal discussion. And by the way, this other debtor, we should be doing X, Y, and Z. It becomes problematic. Borrower information generally by banks is confidential, and you have to start weeding out and redacting things that are private. emails are constantly filled in documents with things like Social Security numbers that involve redaction, other personal characteristics. And attorneys, believe it or not, do their best to try and protect that information from being in the public. But it makes review difficult, I think, of e-discovery documents. In terms of the rules that are before the court today, I think the one thing that I would really like to see added is some provision about information being not reasonably accessible due to undue burden and undue cost. Either or is the way the typical rule reads. When I represent large companies, it's not an issue at all. Most large companies have now what I call the machine. They're used to litigation. They have people in-house that particularly gather the information that starts shifting through it before it ever even gets to my office. Where it becomes problematic, I think, is for smaller and mid-sized businesses who are not used to litigation, who do not have people dedicated to helping deal with the e-discovery litigation process.
Where would you put that, and how would you phrase it?
That's a good question, Your Honor. It's typically an objection that appears in the request for production of documents, so I would assume it would go in 80409.
Okay, I'm on 80409. We have 2B2 is created.
And to be clear, an objection that documents are not reasonably accessible due to undue burden or undue cost does not mean that the documents are not produced. What it is an initial objection to the other side to say, we got problems with your request. I'll give a minor example. I had a case that was a relatively straightforward employment case where the plaintiffs were claiming they deserved overtime pay. They claimed that their employer had misclassified them. The attorneys on the other side had wanted any and all electronic documents, emails, et cetera, that referred to, and they gave me some search criteria, hours worked, and they gave me other search criteria. But they asked me to search company-wide on the topic instead of, for example, just the individual supervisor or top management. The company that I was working for called me back and said, well, we haven't run the whole search. The computer, we've set our computer to run it. It's reached 2 million hits so far, and it keeps going. So I objected to the discovery as not reasonably accessible. I explained that it was going to produce over 2 million records. And I said to the other side, I'm happy to give you what you want if we can figure out how to do it in a way that makes sense. What happened was the other side went back and said, okay, let you provide me, who are the immediate supervisors in the chain for each of the plaintiffs. We'll agree to limit the search to only the email boxes of those individual people. But a plaintiff's attorney can't do that up front. They don't necessarily know what it is that they don't know. Nor do I know when they give me that email, that document request, that it's going to be massive. We can only know because it's a learning process as we go, and the two of us tend to negotiate. We get it down to a manageable number. I say, okay, that's going to produce 25,000 hits. You know, it's going to take us X number of days. It's going to cost X number of dollars. What are we going to do? Are we going to split those costs? Are we going to bear it? And all of that in part depends on what kind of case it is. When you have sophisticated commercial parties on both sides of the aisle, typically they bear their own costs. Why? Because it's all going to come out in the wash. When you don't, it starts getting more difficult. I think most commercial entities, if the cost is within their realm of what they expect for the litigation, they'll just bear it.
Well, we have in 80507 sub 3, which I don't think is amended in this. Upon motion made promptly and in any event at or before the time specified in the subpoena, the court may quash or modify if it is unreasonable and oppressive, or condition denial on advancement of person, blah, blah, on costs. What I'm trying to figure out is what special thing we should do here that relates to protecting the person who, upon whom a request is made. And this rule doesn't change everything in the code. It sort of just adds electronic discovery to the code. It's an overlay. It may be a too broad way that I've stated this. So, but there must be something in the code that says when it's oppressive or too costly, you can get some protection.
The difference, Your Honor, I think, is really about court involvement.
Mm-hmm.
Those portions of the rule require, in my example, a defense counsel to go move for a protective order. The objection and the allowable objection really, what it does, I think, is put the onus on attorneys to try and work it out before going into court. Because if we don't have something, I mean, my objection of it saying undue burden, undue costs, really isn't
a proper objection,
absent some ability for me to object
on
those.
You favor the meet and confer provision mandated. Do you read it as mandatory?
The meet and confer, I've been a little confused about, I must admit, because I think we're using it to describe two instances of conduct. Meet and confer before bringing a motion to compel, I am 100%, 110% in favor of, without a doubt. I would never walk into a court and file a motion to compel without having tried to confer with the other side. I do think in cases with pro se litigants, that's difficult, and I generally, I'm not 100% certain these rules make sense in those instances. The Western District Court, does have a special order for pro se litigants, and they do things differently for them.
That's a local order for here.
Correct.
And then, as I understand the federal system, there are a lot of different local variations on the federal rules, including the whole Seventh Circuit.
Correct.
Which has pilot programs going. So the concept that the federal rules cover everybody and include everything is not quite right.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I think they make exceptions for example, pro se litigants, especially because e-discovery and e-filing can be a benefit or a burden to a pro se litigant. And I think the court's Rule 16F conference in the Western District, at least, attempts to figure out does it help or hinder a pro se litigant and figure out
I want to get back to meet and confer before compelling is good. What's the other meet and confer that's just at least raising a question for you?
The meet and confer that is up front before any discovery is done. And basically it's a discovery conference to talk about how you're going to deal with electronically stored information. To be honest, in my mind, that conference is somewhat of a, what I'll call a neutral. When attorneys meet and confer, whether it be the federal court and the state court, before they have their client documents, you don't know what you don't know. You don't have a clue what you're going to be getting from your own client in response to, when they get a discovery request to know what you need to plan for. Personally, I think if you're going to have a meet and confer, it almost makes sense to do it after both sides have served the first round of discovery, but before you've answered. Because then you know how big are they asking for, how many documents are they asking for, what's the scope of it. You can go to your client and get a feel for what are we talking about. Are we talking about 10,000 documents? Or are we talking about 1 million documents?
Counsel's smile comes to my face because this opens up a whole, arena of issues. The first meet and confer that you talk about seems to me it's the type of meet and confer that's often found in our local court rules. The trial court judges around the state have issued local rules, and a lot of them say, hey, before you come to me with your arguments, you should get together and talk, loosely stated. Then you went to the second meet and confer, which you described as kind of a neutral discovery conference. Then you went to the third meet and confer, which you described as, you thought the best, after both rounds had served their discovery and you knew then what you didn't know, as opposed to you don't know what you don't know. In looking at the proposal before the court, Which meet and confer is being addressed, in your opinion?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the proposal that's before the court, you probably know it better than I in terms of where the provisions are. I would say,
let me point out.
I was going to say, I'm sure you're trying to make a point, Your Honor, and I believe it's a meet and confer before the production of documents.
So it's the second, the neutral.
Yes.
Meet and defer. It's not the one covered by local rules. Hey, you guys, get together.
Correct.
It's the second of the options that's covered.
And it's 16F if you're under the federal rules is what it's a 16F conference.
I think then under our current order, it would be 804.014M, which is at any time after commencement of an action around the court's own motion, et cetera. So it's that second meet and confer that you think is addressed here. Is that by the language of this
Correct.
Rule? And do you interpret that to be a mandatory meet and confer for all cases?
I would agree with Attorney Edwards. I believe he thought it was mandatory for ESI or for electronically stored information discovery, but not mandatory for.
But not mandatory what? I didn't hear that.
I believe it wasn't mandatory if you did not have any electronic discovery. Is that correct? That's my understanding.
Okay. Counsel, anything else you want to say?
Do you favor adoption of these rules?
I don't take a position on the rules, only because, I think this is a very difficult task. The one other point that I wanted to make that I think is sometimes lost is a little bit of practicality with respect to e-discovery. I will say that I don't consider myself an expert when it comes to electronic documents, but a lot of folks in my firm think I know more than they do on electronic discovery. I think it's probably because I've sloshed through as many documents as I have. There is a fallback that I think most attorneys use because they don't understand the electronic medium. They want things in native. They want things, and they're not even, I don't think a lot of attorneys are even certain what they're asking for. And that's
the question that I think has been referred to as form.
Yes. It's actually more problematic, I think, than most attorneys realize. It is rare that I ever want to produce anything in native. If you produce something in native format, you can't bait stamp it. And it can be manipulated by the other side. I want to know when I walk into a deposition with my client, when they hand them a document, if it's got a bait stamp on it, that I know that document is the document as it was produced by me. When you have native documents, it becomes more problematic. I think the difference, occasionally native documents are helpful and necessary. I'll give you
There's a provision in here that about form, and it doesn't say what kind of form, but it indicates you can ask for the form you want. Doesn't mean the other guy has to give it to you in that form, but what is it you would like the rule to say?
Well, I think with respect to the rules, the impression that I get is it puts a lot of onus on attorneys to go into court and either ask for protective orders or ask for variances, et cetera. And I think for the most part, there should be more conferring with the attorney on the other side before any of that becomes necessary.
Okay. Would you favor a provision that says before you ask the court to intervene, you have to show that you have conferred with the other side and no agreement can be reached.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That would cover everything, form and other issues too, costs.
But I would like the objection to undue burden and costs.
Yeah, that's all.
Equalizes, I think,
sure.
The issue as opposed to, I really can't make that objection. It puts, I have to spend client money to go to get a protective order instead of making the objection and then forcing a conference with the other side, which is what I would prefer.
Okay.
Do you think we could add a provision to 805.07 sub 3, which already talks about the court's getting involved with unreasonable or oppressive discovery, just and add and for information not being reasonably accessible due to undue burden or cost, so the court has those additional criteria to apply?
I think that would be fine. Anywhere you shoehorn it in, I'll use it. I'll say that.
All right. Thank you.
And then the one last thing, I wanted to address a question that the Chief Judge asked, Chief Justice asked with respect to clawbacks and what I refer to as, or what is referred to often as quick peaks. I believe, Your Honor, that you had suggested that we could deal with it in 805 and in the privileges section. My only comment to that is that it is much more prevalent with electronic discovery than it is with paper discovery. Electronic discovery is in every case I'm in, whether it be a small case or a large case. Large document production is only in typically the more sophisticated commercial litigation. For example, I'll give you a common example. I'll just take a divorce case. Take a divorce case. I don't know. Inevitably, one spouse wants the other spouse's text messages. They want to know if they're, you know, if they've been faithful or if they've been saying bad things to the nanny about this, that, and the other thing. So electronic discovery, I think, is weaved into almost every case, whereas the large document cases where you're going to have problems in terms of did you miss something that's attorney-client privilege, I think that happens much more in e-discovery cases than
not necessarily in divorce cases. It can involve the value of a corporation, which may include an electronic discovery. In fact, I think we either have one on the docket or came up in a petition for review, and that the issue is the valuation of a business, which might very well involve electronic discovery. So you never know where it's going to happen.
Very true, very true. And
the only question is that you may only get it in large cases because that's where the only time the party is going to either afford to ask for it or afford to give it.
I think that's the case. I think, clawback and quick peaks, whether they survive standard traditional waiver analysis is open for debate. But from a private practitioner's point of view, it's nice to have a little cover if you can get it.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear? Hearing no one, we'll recognize Judge Sankovitz. Judge Sankovitz, just to remind everyone here who wasn't here the last time, you were active in the Judicial Council in drafting this document.
I was on the team.
Right. Okay.
But I want to make myself clear this morning. First of all, I want to say good morning. I'm here not as a representative of the Judicial Council. The Judicial Council has submitted a letter stating its official position after deliberation and after a vote. I'm here more or less on behalf of the worker bees out in 72 courthouses, well, actually 70 courthouses around the state who have to apply these
rules. Let me just interrupt you for a moment. The position of the Judicial Council is that they still want the rule and the court wants the meet and confer as drafted is okay.
That's right.
Okay, good. All
Chief,
right, that's number one.
Chief,
okay.
I didn't understand that. I understood the position of the Judicial Council to be that they still prefer their amended petition, but in choosing the language, given options, they would go with the language that the court drafted at the table in
right.
June. That's
okay.
I understand.
That's
good. That's set forth in their letter.
Looking back to April Southwick and have gotten the high sign. That is the Judicial Council's position.
All right. So they're not here to oppose the amended.
No.
As the court amended the provision. Go ahead.
No.
Okay.
And frankly, on behalf of the worker bees, as I said in the email that I sent to the court, either option's fine with the judges who have to manage these disputes. The judges want the tools.
Just one more moment. I just want to call everybody's attention to the fact that we sent an email to every circuit court judge in the state saying, here's the proposal. Do you have, and we want comments on it.
And
especially on meet and confer, since that was a dispute in the court, but there were other comments, other things. We got that one response.
Right.
Okay. I just wanted that clarified for everybody. Now you can tell us about the judges.
And I think there's two things you can infer from that silence. One is what we said right at the outset. Electronic discovery is not a problem in Wisconsin right now. So it's not in most judges' radars. Secondly, for those judges who are aware of the issue and are ready to grapple with it, what we're doing here is fine. They know we're being responsible and we're taking conservative steps to address the subject, and they've got the tool they want, which is the ability to order parties to get together and talk and figure things out before the judge has to go in and mandate how they're going to try to solve their problems, especially judges who don't know the facts of that particular case and may not know the ins and outs of electronic discovery. So I think the worker bees are pretty happy, except that if they'd heard what Mr. Edwards said and what the, how the court responded, I think the hive would start to buzz a little bit.
And, counsel, that was not only with regard to the definition given by Attorney Edwards, but Attorney Zylstra also apparently interpreted the meet and confer differently than you interpret.
Right. I don't disagree with what most of Mr. Edwards said, and I think down the line when electronic discovery becomes more, let's say, less pricey, more useful, and more available to the practitioner on every main street in the state, we'll get more issues and we may need more sophisticated rules than we have offered here. But one thing that Mr. Edwards said and one thing the court seems to respond to, I think, is going to cause problems. You look at that 61-word sentence in 804.01, sub 4M, sub AM, the first sentence here. Judges are going to read that to say, I don't have to order anybody to meet and confer unless somebody brings a motion.
Excuse me.
That's right. I was a counsel once.
Judge, first of all, let me say thank you for caring enough to be here and to comment now and in the past, and how much I appreciate that, and I know the court does deeply. But when I just heard your comment, which is consistent with your communication with the court, I was taken aback because I thought your interpretation was different than the court's interpretation. That's why I asked the question of interpretation from regarding this very sentence and this very provision of the two earlier presenters, because they interpret it differently than you do. So I'm not confident that the rest of the judges, let alone the rest of the practitioners or the pro se folks in this state, are going to interpret it the way you do.
Let me say why I raised the point, why the bees are buzzing. They don't care whether it's mandatory to begin with or whether the court orders it. They just want to know what the rule means. The buzzing that you hear among trial judges is, give us a clear rule. And the reason you have a dispute here is because you have two concepts that seem to be wedded into a single sentence. Now, when you have a 61-word sentence, most people are going to stop reading after, say, the first 20 words. And the first 20 words have this part about on the court's own motion or the motion of a party. So judges are going to say, no motion, no order.
Counsel, excuse me, just think of this. Here, we're doing it to you again. We're so used
That's
to
all right.
lawyers testifying, and it's nice of you to take the time and come. If we broke the sentence into two parts, one that happens when there is a motion or the court on its own motion does something, and then a separate subsection talking about before bringing anything before the court, the parties must confer if they're going to undertake e-discovery. Would that help to clarify what we're trying to talk about here, or at least what we thought we were trying to talk about?
Yes, although that's actually a third different interpretation, what you just said.
Well, the way I understand the rule that I voted for, okay, the lawyers were obligated, if they were going to do e-discovery, to confer with one another before they began it. Okay? But if either they did not reach an agreement, or for some reason the court wanted to put its oar in the water, that was also not precluded. So the attorney could move the court for something that whatever the parties did in their conference didn't satisfy that attorney, or the judge, who may be looking through what he's going to schedule in the scheduling order, could, on its own motion, bring something. So what I thought, that's what I thought I voted for. And I think that is what the rule says as I still read it today. Okay. Now, it may be confusing because you have two concepts, one geared on a motion or sua sponte, which I guess you can argue is yet a third concept, and another one that's just mandatory on attorneys who practice before the courts of Wisconsin who anticipate doing e-discovery in the case that they're currently involved with.
Let me say what I mean by three options. One option you have is the parties can do whatever they want, but if they don't want to meet and confer, one of them can go to the court and ask the court to order them to meet and confer.
Yeah, I don't see that. Not what I thought I voted for.
Okay, that's
right
one
there.
Choice.
Okay.
The second choice is the parties have to meet and confer before they even send out the document request.
Right.
A third choice is the parties should meet and confer, and if they can't agree, and they want to bring, one of them wants to bring a motion, then they have to meet and confer before they come to court on the motion. That's a typical discovery.
Yeah, see, we maybe need to say it better, but what you're saying is not what I voted for, and I don't think it's what the majority of the court voted for. We wanted a mandatory conference, as there is in the federal rules. Now, did you ever practice in federal court?
Yes.
Did you ever use e-discovery in federal court?
No, in 1996 when I was appointed, electronic discovery was in its very earliest phase.
Right, and I joined the court in 96 also, so I understand that it wasn't available.
But what happened in the 1990 amendments, or the 1991 amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, mm-hmm. was Rule 16, court-supervised discovery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the meet and confer rule started, not with electronic discovery, with court-supervised discovery.
Right. I understand all of that.
So I want to help the worker bees here first and foremost. It doesn't strictly matter to me. I think it's going to matter to a lot of pro se litigants, but it doesn't strictly matter to me whether we order them to meet and confer first and then go to court or whether they go to court and then meet and confer. But there should be clarity so there's no dispute about it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree there should be clarity. And it was our understanding of those of us that supported the conference that this occur before the court intervention would occur, because it just saves money. If the lawyers can agree on it, it's a lot less expensive than going to court and fighting about it.
I won't necessarily say it saves money, but it doesn't take any of my money. So, I'm neutral. Now, let me say this. The court's idea of adding this mandatory concept was put into a subordinate clause in a sentence where mm-hmm. it modifies the court's ability to order. So if you take the grammarian's book off the shelf, you're going to find that this is not what you had in mind.
Okay, so
if
we
you
need
have that in
drafting.
Mind, if what you have in mind is that the parties have to confer before they launch any discovery, then there's two.
E-discovery, not any discovery.
Electronic discovery, but as we've heard, it could be any case. And now, you know, new lawyers come to the practice, they get a form out of a form book, they think they're just looking for a couple documents. I want the lease, I want the termination letter. I want the medical records. Mm-hmm. But they pull that form off the shelf, and you know what the form says? Mm-hmm. Documents, as used herein, is defined to include electronically stored information. Every document request seeks electronically stored information these days. So it's going to be every case. Now, the point I was going to make is this. If you adopt the proposal you have in mind, you can jettison the sub-BM that we drafted over the last week, because that's not going to help. And you need two additional features to this rule to make it clear and workable in our courts. First of all, you have to make an explicit statement to parties that they are not allowed to propound discovery and they are excused from responding to discovery until they have the meet and confer. Otherwise, you have this cat and mouse game where one party sends the discovery out and the other party just stays silent saying, well, we didn't meet and confer, so I guess I don't have to answer the discovery. The 30-day clock runs out, then you have a dispute dropped into the trial judge's lap about whether one party's in default or not. The rule should be clear on whether a party is allowed to propound or to respond to discovery before they have the meet and confer. You walk into a separate problem that we just heard about with whether parties are meeting and conferring before they do any discovery. What you hear from practitioners is that if you have a case where you know there's going to be some real thoroughgoing electronic discovery, the first thing you do is discovery. You actually ask the other side for what you call in federal practice a 30B6. In our numerology, I can't remember the exact number, but it's a deposition of a corporate representative who, for example, in an electronic discovery case, would be the IT manager for the company that tells you where all the stuff is. So if you have a dispute, for example, over a sales distributor who has left and taken business with her, you want to find out, okay, where are her computers? Did she have a home computer? Did she use a PDA? Did her supervisors contact her? Where were the files backed up? Blah, blah, blah. That's discovery. And what you're proposing is that even before they have that 30B6, that they sit down and meet and confer, which is fine, but let them know that they can't do the 30B6 until they've met and conferred. That's one feature.
I think that the rules, as we have enacted them, wouldn't avoid a deposition of the IT person to ask them those questions. What the rules say is before you do electronic discovery, not a deposition where you're just going to ask somebody some questions. But isn't a question
about where the electronic information is? Isn't that discovery of electronically stored information?
I don't think asking questions like that is what the rules envision. I think what the rules envision is what the federal rules envisioned, which isn't as you're representing it here to us.
Okay. Well, then maybe what we have to do is take a giant step backwards, send it back to the Judicial Council just on this issue to talk about whether Wisconsin is ready for a court-supervised discovery, because that meet and confer that you're talking about takes place in federal court as part of a Rule 16 conference that precedes a scheduling conference where the parties have to put together a discovery plan for the approval of the court. We don't have that in Wisconsin.
No, I understand all of that, and I think we can certainly make our rules more complicated. But what we hope to do was to give as much advice as possible to counsel and to the trial courts on how they were to manage concerns about e-discovery, knowing that the trial judges have a lot of Wisconsin case law and have a lot of experience generally in handling other types of discovery issues that come up. But because e-discovery is new, and because the courts now are managing it kind of with the old rules when it does come up, it was thought, and I think by the Judicial Council, which is why they propounded the e-discovery rules to us to begin with, that the trial courts and the parties would all benefit by a little more expression from the court on what might be the appropriate task to take with e-discovery. So I think there was an acknowledgement by the Judicial Council and also by the court that e-discovery is a little bit different than what the courts have been managing so far, and not that the courts were unable to manage it, but that more guidance would be helpful and hopefully more cost-effective for the parties that come before the court.
Then there's one other feature I think you'd have to address if you want to go that route. That is to make it clear for the parties what happens if they meet and confer and they can't agree.
That's right.
You know, the parties that meet and
bring
confer.
Bring a motion. That's what I thought the first part of the rule was about.
We got to say something about that so judges know what that is, so parties know. Because the worst thing you have is the parties meet and confer. They don't agree.
Yeah.
They both go back to their corners and they sit and wait.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great suggestion.
Well,
very good suggestion.
You have three points in this, Judge Stankovich. As I understand the goal of the five people who voted for meet and confer, it is that the parties should meet and confer and reach reasonable agreements if they can. Okay, so what can happen? First, they refuse to meet and confer. One party does. So it seems to me then you have to have a court order.
Or you have the hammer of, if you don't meet and confer, you can't serve any discovery, and we don't have to answer
your
discovery.
That would be one solution. Another solution is get a court order.
Right.
Bring them in a court and see if the court can't do it. And the second one is they do meet and confer, but they can't agree. So it seems to me if they don't meet and confer or they can't agree, you ought to have the same response. I think you ought to make things simpler rather than more complicated. So it sounds to me that if you think that's not clear, that it can't be that hard to draft. You got to meet and confer. If you don't, court, the party can come to court. You do meet and confer.
We have this difficulty of making sure we can do what Justice Rogenczak says would be permissible, which is to talk about electronic discovery in discovery without discovering electronically stored information.
That's right. That's right. And I think that will be a problem.
And I'm not just talking about gamesmanship. It makes practical difference because, as we heard, to have a meet and confirm when you don't know what the other side's electronic architecture is like, where its documents are, even what you're actually looking for, is a kind of a hollow meet and confer. Once you find that out, maybe then it's wise to do a meet and confer. So we have to be able to draft the rules to guide the parties to that, maybe to force the parties to that, but then impose a reasonable result on it.
But the whole point of the meet and confer is that if they're reasonable, they're going to say, here's the format that we have the electronic data in. Here's what we can do easily. Here's what we cannot do easily. That's going to cost a lot of money, and we're going to object to it. I mean, that's the whole point about meet and confer, is to get away from the deposition but see if you can't do it informally and by agreement.
Right.
Okay. You agree that would be the objective.
That would have to be the objective.
Right. And if they can't agree, then they've got to go to court.
Right.
Okay.
So, I mean, on that point then, and I'll just finish with this, if this is something that needs a little bit more baking, let's take 80401-4M out of the rules. Let the other rules go into effect on January 1st. Send us back to the drawing board, see if we can come up with something. And
what's the 401-4M? The meet and confer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That may not be necessary.
It's not likely.
Yeah, because it's a drafting issue. All right. Because the at least five members of the court have made a decision what they wanted.
Okay.
Okay. So the point is, does the rules, I wasn't one of them, but does the rule state what they wanted? And if it doesn't, we can amend it and add whatever has to be done to fit that. All right.
Right.
I have another question for you.
Okay.
Let's go to what people have been objecting to. Cost shifting. As I heard Mr. Edwards, he would like, at least in the comments, specific criteria that are found in the federal rules, and that the commentary would say, here's what you might think about.
We considered that. If you look in the comments to the federal rules, you'll find six of the seven so-called Zubelake factors. They're laid out there for federal judges and for federal practitioners. And we could have just cut that out and pasted it onto our rules, except that commentary refers to a federal rule that we don't have. And this will touch on another thing I'm sure is on your list. That's the reasonable accessibility rule. It's 26 sub B, sub 2, sub capital B. And that's the one that's buried into the very, into the masthead, so to speak, of the discovery rules, which says specific limitations on electronically stored information. We decided not to adopt that because, following the same conservative approach we followed all the way through, we don't feel like we need to adopt a new rule about reasonable accessibility when reasonable accessibility itself boils down to undue burden.
Okay, so where is undue burden covered in our rules?
I don't know if I could give you a number site, but that's...
How about 80401-3A, which says, upon motion by a party or by the person from whom discovery is sought and for good cause shown, the court may make any order with which justice requires to protect a party or person from annoyance, embarrassment, oppression, or undue burden.
Right. So we have the rule in place.
Protective orders.
Right. And that's how these Zubelake came up, was through a party seeking a protective order. Now, Judge Scheinlein and Zubelake, when she was presented with this issue, she didn't have a rule. She didn't even have a federal comment. But she did have common sense and some good lawyers. She came up with seven factors. Six of those factors made the cut, so to speak, and got into the federal rules. Those federal rules are similar to our rules. I don't think there's a judge in Wisconsin who would say, oh, I'm not going to listen to the federal rules. That's for federal courts, not for me. I think you can trust the worker bees to look at these comments, to look at the scholarship, to look at the parties, and say, yeah, these are reasonable factors. I'll consider these in deciding what's an undue burden.
Senkovitz, I absolutely trust the trial courts to make reasoned decisions. I mean, we review them all the time, and they do a great job. My concern with the rules is I would like to give attorneys guidance, so hopefully it will be less expensive for the parties. You know, litigation has gotten to be just out of sight for most people. And in fact, I understand from what I read in the papers that today there's going to be a Sybil Gideon petition filed with us because in the smallest of matters, people are having a difficult time operating pro se and they can't afford a lawyer. So, you know, it goes throughout our system. And I guess my question to you is, if we were to list the factors that were suggested to us earlier on. I think Attorney Edwards suggested that we talk about cost shifting and list the things that the court may consider as an assist to the lawyers who will know that the court is going to be looking at accessibility of the data, volume of the data, mechanism for search of the data, and the different criteria that it might make litigation a little less expensive. I have real concerns with the costs, and one of the major factors for me is trying to give as much guidance as possible so that the litigants hopefully can solve their problems to the extent that they can. And do you think that that would be a problem for the judges to have more factors to look at than they have now?
No. I think what the court would have to do is draft a comment and attach it to our current statute, or would have to adopt 26B2B, which, you know, is going to be wortish. It's going to doesn't fit easily into the current structure of our statute. So,
but it wouldn't impair the judge's ability to deal with these issues, do you think?
No, it's not going to impair the judge's ability at all.
Yeah, okay.
It could also refer to 80401-3, which is the protective order, and there's another provision that I referred to before that deals with
that's
protective
on subpoenas.
Orders.
So you'd have to have a parallel provision for third parties
right.
who are subject to discovery.
Right. So the two references, okay, right. plus anything added. So that's cost shifting. Anything else you want to say about cost shifting?
Yeah.
I want to focus in on issues that are in debate, in dispute, and all right. What about privilege?
And then clawback and quick peek.
Pardon me?
And the issues of clawback and quick peek.
Right.
Just for those of you who haven't heard that term before, this isn't voyeurism. Quick peek is when you give the other party a chance to look quickly at some documents that are a sample of what the other side has to see if there are any issues there on the condition that if it turns out you accidentally let the cat out of the bag, that they can't use the documents. And that's what all these things have to do with is the lawyer's duty to protect the client's confidences, the client's secrets. I think that despite the comments, I think that the reasonable thing to do here is to wait until the Judicial Council has debated and decided whether Wisconsin should have a version of Federal Rule 502. That's where we really find out whether or not we are going to make the decision in Wisconsin that client secrets are, it's permissible to give away a client's secrets if it's too expensive to protect them. In deciding that, we're going to decide what duty a client has or a lawyer has to talk to a client about, here's your choices. We can produce 2 million pages of information, and it'll cost you X hundred thousands of dollars to review it, and we'll make sure you don't give away any secrets, or we can produce it without doing the privilege review, and you might lose a secret. You've got to decide, are your secrets important enough to pay that money for? And that's what 502 guides a lawyer to do, and the clawback provisions of the federal civil procedure rule simply says if the parties reach a clawback agreement, the courts will enforce it. But for Wisconsin to adopt a clawback rule without having decided the question of whether inadvertent disclosure of a client's secrets is significant or not would be premature. So we're saying let's hold off on that until we do 502. And I also want to make sure that two words that were used here don't be taken out of context by anybody who would criticize the court or the bar of disregarding the rights of clients. Justice Rogensack talked about malpractice concerns, and we heard the word cover before, that lawyers need some cover. We have to be more respectful of the fact that we're talking about one of our most important duties as lawyers and as a profession, which is to protect these privileges. And we can't be seen as designing rules that are to give lawyers cover and throw the client's secrets under the bus. I think what we do here to avoid a problem is give everybody clarity. And I think that's what we could accomplish if we have a clawback rule, and we can get a clawback rule in place that will work once we have a 502 that works, however that turns out. And so I just don't want to give anybody the impression that what we're aiming for is some kind of lawyer protection device in the rules.
I didn't take the comments of counsel to be trying to protect lawyers, and I would imagine my colleagues did not either. It is something, though, that you see written about in literature that talks about this, that if there is, that the clawback provision in the federal rules are a recognition that because of the volume of electronic discovery, the very best of lawyers, being reasonable under the circumstances, may still inadvertently disclose confidential matters. And that's what my comment was meant to address, certainly not to throw client secrets.
Good. So now the context is clear. And just one side point on that. 10 years from now, we won't have this discussion. 10 years from now, clients will have technology to be able to tag their secrets in such a way that the computer can find out what their secrets are and separate that. You don't have to pay a lawyer to do a privilege review. But we have to do something for the next 10 years. Maybe if I talk long enough, we'll put
we'll get there, right?
Diploma question for 10 years, and then everybody will have made a wasted trip to the Supreme Court today.
Your Honor, I have a question.
Okay.
How's that for a salutation? As the Chief referenced, this mandatory meet and confer was a 5-2 vote, and I voted in the dissent in large part because I thought mandatory rather than leaving it in the discretion of the judge and the parties was going to increase the cost of litigation for everyone and time for the courts. Your response on September 23rd to the court indicated in part you had conferred with at least some other judges, and paraphrasing, I will say, it represented, doesn't make much difference if you go with the amended judicial council language or the council or the language drafted by the majority at the table, because ultimately both are going to be discretionary.
Can I interrupt for just a second to say the judges I talked to didn't read this the way that the court reads it.
They read
it to say that the court can order a meet and confer if the parties ask the court for an order.
If those worker bees, as you had described them, had interpreted it as the court is now making clear it interprets it, do you think it does make a difference? I mean, you've got one is discretionary and one is mandatory. I guess that's a rhetorical question. Sure, now there is a difference. Would it make a difference to those worker bees now that they understand the interpretation of the court to be mandatory is mandatory?
I hate to speak for him without talking.
Hey, let me ask you.
Okay. My feeling is that it's unnecessary and that in the great scheme of things, it will save some costs in some very large dollar volume cases, and in some very small dollar volume cases, it will add to the expense.
What about pro se litigants? One of the comments you made, and I know this was, given the context, you said, it won't cost me any money or something, if you recall initially. But you made some reservation about how it's going to affect pro se. Could you expound on that?
Well, here's the conversation. I mean, Bob Newhart could do this better than I could, but, you know, Mr. Edwards, he has a lawsuit against some farmer whose manure spreader he's trying to take back to satisfy some loan, and he says, this is Tim Edwards, I'm calling, I have a duty to talk to you about electronic discovery, I'm going to serve some electronic discovery on you, and we have to meet and confer. And the farmer on the other end of the phone is going, what? I don't know. What? You know, now there's no dollar expense for the farmer to have that conversation, but there is an expense for the bank. They have a conversation that is hollow and unnecessary.
What about if that farmer goes and hires a lawyer and the lawyer is charging, you pick the number, what the hourly fee is, and gets a call then from the bank's attorney. The lawyer does on a case that the lawyer's representing Wausau Hospital in a collection matter involving small claims limit is $5,000, involving either $4,500 or $12,000, that kind of a figure. So the farmer, the neighbor comes, says, okay, lawyer, I've got this problem. It's a small case. How do you envision, if it's mandatory, how would you envision that being handled?
Well, I don't think there's much to the conversation.
It's a short conversation.
It's a short conversation.
It's what we would say in the law, a 0.2 conversation, because there's no conversation. There's no conversation
and law office management manuals.
Well, you obviously haven't had an insurance company reviewing your bills lately. They can put that down for point one.
Okay, point one. And how much is point one of $250? Or how much is point two of $250? Or how much is point four of $250 an hour?
Right. Yeah. I think that's the point. Like I said, in a large dollar case, Justice Rogensack is right. This culture that we're trying to create, this discipline we're trying to create, of getting people to talk about this stuff before they embark on it, is a good thing and will save costs. And the question is, if you aggregate all the costs saved in those big cases, will that make up for the unnecessary costs in the small cases? And where we are at this point in the life and the era of electronic discovery in Wisconsin, I think there's fewer costs to be saved at the high end and more costs to be incurred at the low end.
And the
cost to the court is this, what? Why are they making us do this? We don't have a problem with this.
That's exactly it. Why, and you have that in your letter, why are they making us do this? We have no problem with this. One of the greatest gifts I have had in my life was serving as a circuit court judge for 10 years. And what that did for me is to enhance my sense of smell. What's really going on here? And you know what I read when I read your email and you're talking about the other judges? I said, because you have them there, they say, you know, what are they doing? You know, we don't have this stuff. It's not a problem. You know what most judges in this state are going to do according to my sense of smell? They're going to issue in their scheduling order that there's no need. They're going to get around this complex rule. Let me see the shaking of heads. They're going to get around this complex rule for which a mandatory meet and confer, for which there is no need, by issuing a standard order saying you don't have to. That will allow those who really need it to have to make a motion. Do you disagree with my smell?
I'd say that's one possibility. The other possibility is that it just becomes a dead letter because it's not used in most cases and it never comes to their attention. They're like, oh, I don't have to worry about that. And then it only comes up in the case where somebody hasn't followed the rule, and then the other side comes up guns blazing asking for sanctions. You served this document request on me asking for electronically stored information. You didn't do a meet and confer, and I'm not answering it. And because I had to spend point two reading it, I want my costs. You know, I think that where we're going on trying to save costs is an admirable idea. I think that's where we should be headed, and that's the signal we want to send to the people like Mr. Edwards and his firm that are very involved in these cases. I just don't think we have to mandate it across the board. But everybody here, I mean, Justice Rogensack, she practices in courts and she knows clients, and Justice Crooks was a trial judge since, what, the Mesozoic era? You know, so...
Easy, counselor.
You know, so...
Pretty close.
The rules about contempt when you're having a judge holding another judge in contempt. I don't know those. I have to study them.
Or over a trial judge because you signed the paychecks. So, I think you have to get your own sense of what this works like across the spectrum. And I trust you to do that. And I think the judges do too. Like I say, all we're looking for is clarity. So if we want to do what the majority did, let's just do it in a way that's clear.
Clarity is excellent, and I appreciate your suggestions very much.
All right. Anything else? Any other issues that have come to the fore that we need commentary on? So on privilege and clawback and quick peek, your concept is wait and do it in 502 that covers everything, including electronic discovery. And is the Judicial Council working on 502?
Yes. And, in fact, I think we will have a great debate about 502. 502 is not an open and closed good idea, even among federal practitioners. Let's find out how that turns out.
Is there anything else you want to say?
Thank you very much for indulging us. I hate to be taking up so much of your time with something that seems so minor. So thank you very much.
Are there any questions by the court? Well, I'd like to say on behalf of the court, yes, I'm sorry. You have to speak fast or I turn.
Sorry, saves the best questions for last.
In your two-page communication with us, or here now, do you have specific language that you're proposing for M that you think would clarify it? And maybe correctly affect the objectives of Justice Rogensack and the majority?
I don't. I would be willing to do this. Teresa Owens and I have worked closely on the language before. I have a lot of experience drafting rules. I'm happy to work on a team to draft those rules, but I don't have language.
The Legislative Reference Bureau had some suggestion for language, too, that attempted, if I remember it, to move out, to separate out the what is a very compacted 4M and was going to divide 4M into AM and then a B, and had some suggestions for that. So you might look at that, which attempted to deal with this.
Sure.
If that ends your presentation, just saying this, I do want to thank you on behalf of the court for all the hard work and on this draft and staying with it and commenting on comments, et cetera. And while you're here and in public, I want to thank you for all your hard work on the report on mental health in the criminal justice system, where you helped organize it, then along with Elise Judges Stark and Patak of Eau Claire and Racine, facilitated meetings and then carefully worked over a report which has gone national and has received very positive responses. I've asked Ms. Owens to send you the positive responses. She will not send you any negative responses. But we haven't gotten them yet. So you know that job well done.
Thank you. And of course, Teresa gets most of the credit. She really did the hard work.
I know.
Bringing her to the court was a great investment of the court's resources. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on 0901? If not, is it all right?
Could we invite Mr. Edwards to respond?
Certainly.
If he wishes to in any way to the comments of Judge Sankovitz.
Mr. Edwards.
I had a few thoughts, and I think one of the big issues that is on the table is cost. Mm-hmm. How each of these decisions will affect the cost that's imposed on the litigants, on the court system, and throughout. And I'm an advocate for, as I said earlier, front-loading this system when it comes to e-discovery and also making sure that the parties and the courts have guidance regarding certain important issues. Because I think, and while I agree that the phone call with the farmer, which is a point two, is a waste of time, I don't think it would be required under the rule as it's written today, because I'm not sure that's an electronic discovery case, but putting that aside, that's a waste, that's a cost to the system and to the litigants. But having the parties convene and having guidance about what they need to address when e-discovery is a central issue and giving them the opportunity to agree on a format to share information about preservation requirements and how documents have been retained and what efforts are made to make sure that they're available, identifying documents that are not readily available, and in really complicated cases, getting experts involved who can help sort through some of the questions. Doing that up front makes that point two cost a nothing, because you're saving thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars by requiring everybody to deal with this up front, because if you don't deal with it up front, it's going to spin out of control if there's a lot of e-discovery involved.
All right. So I understand you want mandatory meet and confer if there's an e-discovery case. Right. If they refuse to meet and confer, then you go to court and get them to meet and confer. And if they do meet and confer but they can't agree, then they got to go to court.
And I think that's a good thing.
I'm just asking.
Yeah, yes, I agree with that.
That's all right.
That's what I thought you were saying before. And
because you could isolate the controversies or the issues up front rather than deal with them after problems have occurred that can't be resolved. You know, like, let's say that the party who has the data isn't preserving it properly. You can catch that up front rather than figuring out 9 months later that it's all gone, it's been destroyed, they haven't, you know, suspended a document retention policy like they're supposed to. So because of the complexity of e-discovery, I think the more that you front-load and guide the parties, the better. And I'll tell you, if I understood this correctly, there was one response to the circulation of these questions regarding e-discovery from the trial court judges. That's a big concern, in my opinion.
Well, we thought very seriously that this affects trial court judges and therefore sent out, and that one of the things missing in our spring and then June conference was we hadn't heard from trial judges who were on the sidelines and had not been intimately involved in the drafting or in the discussions at the Judicial Council. And we did, literally, we got one response, which said, I think it's a good idea to meet and confer. And I do that.
Yeah, and I don't know what to infer from that. I mean, there are some things that come to mind that could be troubling.
Well, there are a lot of things on people's minds that don't necessarily involve this rule, and it's a long rule and hard to read, and you've got to read it with the other provisions in the code. And so it's not surprising that you don't get a lot of people doing it, responding. And as Judge Sankovitz has said over and over again, e-discovery has not been a major problem across the state for the state courts.
Right.
And last time I repeated the story that when I asked the bar a number of times as I come back from national meetings, e-discovery, 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 and the response has always been, it's not a major problem in this state. And always it's yet. So that's why I'm not surprised.
Right. And I don't know what is on the dockets of the trial courts right now in terms of, you know, these kind of questions. I think it's good to be proactive.
Sure.
And to put these mechanisms in place. I just, in keeping with my theme of cost savings, just for a second, the cost shifting issue, you know, the Zubilacki opinion, I think, was referenced earlier, is one that didn't even come out of the rules as far as identifying the factors. So we're not pulling something out of a rule that doesn't apply and superimposing it onto our rulemaking process. It's really kind of a common law approach, if you really look at it, that's based on one of the other federal rules. That's easily translatable, and we can use it. And if we do use it, I think it also saves costs. I think it saves a lot of money because you're providing guidance about, you know, what it is that you need to do to avoid paying for discovery as a lawyer. And it pushes the incentives both ways. And you can see how the battle starts to tilt depending on how those variables are satisfied in the discussions that you have. The meet and confer process should continue throughout the lawsuit if you have a complicated e-discovery case. That's the way to save money. And getting the lawyers to cooperate and to work together is the most efficient way of making this work.
I want to thank you, Mr. Edwards, and I want to thank Mr. Mitby for your comments today and for your lengthy writings previously. And they've been all on very good topics that may very well come up in the future or today. And want to thank the other lawyers who have responded to the court previously. So thank you.
May I ask
one
other question? If I understood the discussion here from Attorney Sarah, and I didn't get the last name, from Boardman, and I think from Judge Sankovitz, I'm not sure that this rule tells me precisely when the meet and confer should happen. Do we need to be more specific about that?
If I were to draft this rule, I would take out the part about electronic discovery and move it.
And what? I didn't
and move it. Mm-hmm. Yep, down, underneath all of the factors and create a new subsection. I don't have it in front of me, but it would basically state not only the fact that meet and confer is mandatory if the case involves electronic discovery. I was talking to John Mitby about how to do this. I mean, do you tie it into the pretrial conference? I don't think you can. Maybe you require it within 30 days after the responsive pleading is filed or something like that to make sure it happens up front. But the other thing missing from this rule, in my opinion, is guidance about what they need to meet and confer about.
That isn't in the sub?
It is, but I think that there are other issues unique to electronic discovery that have to be on the table at the front end. What's the form of the data, how it's going to be kept during the course of the litigation, what's inaccessible, what's accessible, all of that. And I know that in the Farmer case, that doesn't even come up. In fact, I don't think you make that phone call in the Farmer case because the case doesn't involve e-discovery. Maybe you call the farmer and ask, do you have a computer? And if he says no, say, okay, we'll talk to you soon. Right? That's the end of it.
But if he has a computer?
Well, then you got to say, do you have any data that's relevant to this lawsuit? And if he says, yeah, I think I do, well, I want to just talk to you about where it is and how we can get it, and let's just come to agreement on that because that will avoid problems down the line. And that may save a lot of time and effort dealing with a motion to compel later. It may be worth that point, too.
Could write, before the service of any discovery request for electronically stored information, parties shall confer, unless otherwise ordered by the court, on the discovery of electronically stored information, blah, blah, blah. Or, in cases involving the discovery of electronically stored information, the parties shall confer, et cetera. So that would give a time.
Yeah, I think the when and the what, to me, was missing. I mean, the when is this obligation triggered and what it is that needs to actually be discussed so that it's a meaningful conversation. Understand that this doesn't apply in a lot of these cases. I don't know, like I said earlier, what the trial dockets look like. But in the one or two that are really complicated, I mean, this could help a lot.
If I may. Since the mandatory confer is going to be the rule of the court, it's my goal to get the best rule there is.
Right.
And your comments, you say when and where. But it seems, when and what? But that seems to interrelate because if it is too early, I heard you and others say, too early in the process, if it's 30 days after responsive pleadings, for instance, then you know when, but I get back to the earlier phrase, you don't know what you don't know. And so you don't know perhaps the what. How do you make most meaningful in this mandatory confer rule the when to allow for the most meaningful what discussion?
I think the when has to be early because then I think the what becomes what data is available, where is it being preserved, where, is it accessible? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I do apologize, but it has to be early for me isn't good enough. Because one of the things that comes to mind when I was thinking earlier about judges sending out scheduling orders, 120 days, is 120 days early? Is 30 days after responsive pleadings early? Is after they've already filed discovery requests, but before a response is required early? So if we're going to make this rule the most clear rule, and if when and what are the two most important things, then you've got to tell me when and not just early.
Excuse me, when and not
and today. Not just early.
Well, I think within 30 days of the responsive pleading. And I agree with you that you may run into issues that you don't have enough information to resolve. But it's a heck of a lot better to know that early than after you have served a number of discovery requests and you're fighting over whether data is accessible and you're not getting it in the format that you want and then everything explodes. So that's my thought, it's somewhat arbitrary to say 30 days after the answer. It's the best that I can do on the spot.
Sure.
All right, but I do think that if you're going to have a requirement for a meet and confer, there has to be some guidance as to what the party should meet and confer about.
The inference the implication of what you say is that maybe this needs a little bit more work. I mean, I am not retreating from the basic policy decision that was made earlier that meet and confer ought to be mandatory. But maybe if we're not all on the same page on this, I would hate to kind of go to this table and try to figure it out there.
Any time would be considered is arbitrary, whether it's 30 days, 60 days. What's the matter with saying before there's a discovery? What's the matter with saying at any time after commencement of the action, in cases involving discovery electronics destroyed information, before service of a discovery request for electronic, you got to meet and confer. What's the matter with that?
One problem comes to mind potentially,
right,
and it relates to the preservation of data. Sometimes in the meet and confer, you discover that the other party hasn't clamped down and preserved the data.
Okay.
And so if you're waiting and it goes 3 months, 4 months before you serve discovery requests, something could be lost or missing.
Mm-hmm.
That's one idea.
Sure, but that's true of any documents.
It is true of any documents.
Sure.
It's particularly true in electronically stored information because many companies have these
automatic.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's
okay.
Just being, you know, thrown off the cliff every 30 days.
All right. All right. So 30 days, fine. It's a time.
It's a thought.
Right. You could even do it on serving. You could even do it on serving the summons and complaint. You've got to keep all data relating to this case, electronic or otherwise.
Well, that a lot of times we'll send a letter to that effect. You have to do it anyway. You know, the question is, and this is tough, and I don't do a lot of rulemaking stuff, but to figure out how much you want to actually micromanage the process.
Exactly.
And I don't know the answer to that. I'm trying to provide the best solutions that I can think of that I think will save money and get things focused in the cases where this matters.
And your position, which is perfectly justifiable, is early, without defining it, because there are a lot of different ways. It might be defined, and it might be different in different cases.
That could be.
Okay. You've been very helpful, Mr. Edwards. I'm glad you came back.
Oh, I'm glad I did, too. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Any other comments? I've thanked, on behalf of the court, Judge Sankovitz, but there are some other, I don't know if I like the expression worker bees, because then I've got to define a queen bee. And then,
definition though, don't we?
And then I've got to worry about this because I don't remember my bees well enough. Somebody dies in the bee community as soon as they finish something. And I really don't like that concept here for two reasons. One, I don't think that is the sentence to be imposed as a result of working on this. And two, I don't think you're going to be done. Regardless of what the court does, it seems to me there's more work ahead. But I do want to recognize the people who I see in the audience who have worked on this. And if I've missed someone, that person is to stand and identify himself or herself. So I see Judge Lyne Weber, Richland County. I see Attorney William Gleisner. I see Attorney Tom Burtz and Attorney Richard Moriarty. And I see April Southwick, who is with the Judicial Council, the staff. Is there anyone whom I've missed, Ms. Southwick? Okay. But we thank all the ones who are not present also. And if you would convey those thanks, I'd appreciate that. Thank you. That concludes our hearing on 0901 in the matter of amendments of various statutes relating to electronic discovery. I'm going to move to 0909 in the matter of the petition to amend or repeal Supreme Court Rule 40.03 on the diploma privilege. And the presenter on behalf of numerous petitioners who are mentioned, the presenter will be Attorney Stephen Levine. On the table. All right, how are we doing? We've been sitting for 2 hours, so everyone is entitled to stand up.
And be counted, please.
And then we're going to proceed.
Good. I heard it's wonderful.
I once got into hot water when I had aerobics in the courtroom, so we won't do anything like that. But standing is okay. All right. Are we set? All right. The court is now going to deal with the petition to amend or repeal Supreme Court Rule 40.03. I have a Mr. Levine, and then I've got 12 appearances, and I'm going to call on James Bowell, the president of the State Bar of Wisconsin, to appear first. Will that fit with your schedule, Mr. Bowell? Will that fit with your schedule? Okay. Mr. Levine.
If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Levine. I'm an attorney from Madison. I'm here today representing myself and 70-some petitioners who've signed a petition asking the court to amend Supreme Court Rule 4003, the diploma privilege rule, either to extend the diploma privilege to graduates of ABA-approved law schools located outside Wisconsin, or in the alternative, to consider repealing the diploma privilege entirely.
Make everyone take the bar.
Make everyone take the bar. The preferred alternative and the first alternative that's mentioned in the petition, however, is to extend the requirements of the diploma privilege to graduates of ABA-approved law schools outside Wisconsin. And I have three arguments that I want to cover. First, that it's unfair and discriminatory to only require a certain group of ABA-approved law school graduates to take the bar exam and not others. Second, that on a cost-benefit analysis, the state of Wisconsin receives very little, if any, benefit from administering the bar exam. And third, that for those of you, both on the court and in the audience, who feel that preserving the diploma privilege for the UW and Marquette law schools is very important to you, I want to make a practical argument, some would say a political argument, but the demographics of the state bar are switching to the point where if in a few years the diploma privilege is to be preserved for graduates of UW and Marquette, the best way to do that is to extend it to graduates of other law schools as well, to expand the basis of support for the diploma privilege, because there is coming a time within not too long when the bar of Wisconsin is going to be much closer divided between graduates of UW and Marquette and graduates of other law schools, and that it will be a benefit in preserving the diploma privilege for UW and Marquette to extend it to other law schools as well. First, let me begin by giving a little bit of background about what exactly is involved in taking the bar exam. First, the people who take the bar exam. To me, I believe it's irrelevant as far as where they come from. I believe in treating all people the same. But to the extent that it is a consideration that some of you want to weigh in the equation, most of the people who take the bar exam are Wisconsin residents who, for one reason or another, either they want to attend a law school outside Wisconsin, or there aren't enough seats at UW-Marquette and they are forced to attend law school outside Wisconsin. They attend law schools outside Wisconsin and then they come back to their home state to practice. There are a certain amount of people who their contact with Wisconsin, they're coming here for a job, they've never had any previous contact with Wisconsin. But for the most part, we're talking about the majority of people who take the Wisconsin bar exam are Wisconsin residents. Second, what is the burden that's imposed on these people in taking the Wisconsin bar exam? It's both a financial burden and it's a burden in time. Doing some quick calculation based upon some simple numbers from the last bar exam, where we had about 200 people take the July bar exam in the past. Now, I've been told by some of these people that the bar preparation course that they took can vary from anywhere from $2,500 up. Some people said that the course they took was much more expensive. But I use that $2,500 figure because we'll be very conservative here. And we're talking about for 200 people, if you multiply by $2,500, you get $500,000. There's another financial cost that's imposed by the bar exam, and that's the cost of not being able to be employed for 4 months from June through September until the person who's taken the bar exam is certified as having passed the bar exam, while members of UW and Marquette are sworn in during the spring and have that whole summertime of income wherever they're employed. And again, using a bare bones figure of perhaps that each person who passed the bar exam would earn what I think might be even a below the poverty line salary of $30,000 a year. If we divide that by three for the 4 months that they're unable to practice because of the bar exam, we get a total of $10,000 multiplied by 200 is $2 million. So financially, and again, these are just ballpark figures, but we're talking about a financial cost in dollars of perhaps $2.5 million in the aggregate for these 200 people who are required to take the Wisconsin bar exam. In addition to that, if we count up the hours that people are required to study for the bar exam, again, using as conservative figures as I could remember, if we assume that people will study 3 hours a day for the bar exam for 8 weeks, we're talking about a total of 25,000 hours among all of those 200 people. So just using the bar exam that was administered in July, we're talking about a financial burden of $2.5 million and a time burden of 25,000 hours in the aggregate. 25,000 hours of study, which means that people would not be able to spend time with friends, with family, with children, both a financial burden and a time burden. And the question is, number one, is it discriminatory to place this burden only on graduates of ABA-approved law schools located outside Wisconsin, but not on UW and Marquette graduates? And also, what does the state of Wisconsin gain from a pure utility viewpoint, from a cost-benefit analysis? Is the bar exam doing its job? Is it worthwhile to impose that burden on the people who have to take the bar exam? The petition that's before you asks that the court extend the diploma privilege to graduates of ABA-approved law schools outside Wisconsin for a 10-year trial period. It's just a test to see if during that period the diploma privilege can work.
What's the evaluation during the 10 years?
Well, the best evaluation would be if nothing happened.
Well, what's going to happen is a lot of people are going to be in the bar. There's going to be a percent of the bar which is going to get into OLR difficulties or CLE difficulties, right? So do we measure an increase in this difficulty? How do you evaluate this?
Sure. I think there are a number of factors you can look at. You can look at complaints to OLR. You can see if during that 10-year period there was a spike up in complaints to OLR, and where did those complaints come from? Were they dealing with people who went to law school outside Wisconsin?
Okay,
that's one objective criteria. Mm-hmm. Another criteria is, let's say the court starts getting emails from judges around the state who are saying, as far as procedure goes, as far as trials, as far as court proceedings, we're having more problems since this change was made, and the problems are coming from lawyers who graduated from law schools outside Wisconsin. I'm talking about, you know, not an anecdote here or there, but a general trend that we can see. You could also consult Wilmick, the Wisconsin Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company, and other insurance companies to see, have their claims during that 10-year period spiked up? If not, if during that 10-year period, if nothing happens, if there's no increase in complaints to OLR, if there are no claims against insurance companies, if there are no problems, then the question arises, why continue to give the bar exam, given this heavy burden? I was not at the Board of Governors meeting last weekend in which the board discussed this issue, but I am told by a couple of Board of Governors members who attended that one of the law school representatives who was there during the discussion very candidly admitted that if the bar exam were given to UW and Marquette graduates, there would be a number who would fail the bar exam, in his estimation, that the performance on the Wisconsin bar exam for UW and Marquette graduates would not be that different from the performance.
In the last bar exam, approximately 9% did not pass.
Right, I'm getting to that point. That's my next point. So the first point to be raised is the discrimination point. Why impose the burden of the bar exam only on graduates of ABA-approved law schools located outside Wisconsin, but not on UW and Marquette graduates? The graduates of ABA-approved law schools outside Wisconsin, obviously, they attend ABA-approved law schools, just like UW and Marquette. They take basically the same curriculum, just like UW and Marquette, and they have their character and fitness certified by the Board of Bar Examiners, just like graduates of UW and Marquette. So the question is, given that there's little, if any, difference between these graduates and graduates of UW and Marquette, why impose this huge financial and time burden on them? The second point that you just mentioned, Justice Abrahamson, the question is it worth $2.5 million and 25,000 hours of study to eliminate 9% of the people who take the bar exam?
About 20 people. I think it were roughly
20, 19 people, whatever. Those 19 or 20 people represent less than one lawyer per 1,000 members of the state bar. By giving the bar exam, you are preventing from practice one lawyer for every 1,000 members of the state bar. And the question is this huge burden that you're placing on these people justified from a utility point of view to eliminate 19 or 20 people from practicing law, given the huge size of the bar in Wisconsin? Third point to emphasize. As I said, the demographics of the state bar are changing. When I took the bar exam 30-some years ago, there were less than 100 people who took the bar exam. Last July, it was almost double that. Right now, the demographic breaks down that 5/8 of the bar have graduated from UW-Marquette, and 3/8 have graduated from law schools located outside Wisconsin. And that percentage, or that fraction, is narrowing. In the year prior to this year, according to figures supplied to me by the state bar, there was a net increase in the population of lawyers in Wisconsin who graduated from UW and Marquette Law School of 217 lawyers. But there was a net increase in the number of lawyers from law schools outside Wisconsin of 261. So there were 44 more lawyers over a year's period who graduated from law schools outside Wisconsin than who graduated from UW and Marquette. That demographic is changing, and it's going to be maybe a few years. It's going to take a long time. But we're getting to the point where you might have a 60-40% split, and it might get 58-59%, where the division between lawyers who have attended in-state and out-of-state schools is going to be closer and closer. And when you get to that point, it won't be unusual or out of the realm of possibility to think that someday there will be four members of this court who will be graduates of law schools outside of Wisconsin. And the question is then, what's going to happen to the diploma privilege? I would suggest that to those people on the court who feel that preservation of the diploma privilege for UW and Marquette is very, very important, that the way to preserve the diploma privilege is to share it, to expand the base of support for it. If the court were to grant this petition and for the next 10 years, 200 people a year were admitted under the diploma privilege from law schools outside Wisconsin, you would form a base of support for the diploma privilege so that if there came a time when the demographics changed and the percentage in the bar of people who graduated from out-of-state law schools were very large, and perhaps the majority of this court was made up of graduates of out-of-state law schools, you would have support for continuing the diploma privilege at the in-state law schools, because you've expanded it and included people who've gone to other law schools. Whereas if you don't expand it, and it's limited only to UW and Marquette graduates, what's going to happen when there's that tipping point and the majority of members on this court may be from out-of-state law schools and a huge percentage of the bar is made up of graduates of out-of-state law schools?
You think the resentment to the diploma privilege would expand and take over the court and the bar?
Well,
your basic point then is if there are more people in the bar and on the court that don't have the advantage of the diploma privilege, they'll demand either the diploma privilege or that no one gets it. I mean, that's your point.
Well, demand might be a strong word. They'll be very persuasive in arguing that. I mean, I don't understand, as the demographic gets closer and closer, and you have an organization like the State Bar, which will be making a presentation after I get done, to support giving the diploma privilege only to graduates of UW and Marquette. How can you hold a profession together when basically 60% of the profession is telling 40% of the profession, when it comes to bar admission, we want you to be treated as a second-class citizen? I mean, you can't have a cohesive bar if you treat people like that. So my suggestion is, from a purely political standpoint, the best way to preserve the diploma privilege and to preserve cohesiveness in the bar is to spread the basis of support for the diploma privilege by extending it to graduates of all ABA-approved law schools. Now, I want to emphasize again, because I think there's been a lot of misrepresentation when people have discussed this issue. What is being proposed here is not a permanent change. What is being proposed here is a 10-year test. 10-year period was taken so that it's a long enough period so that the court can come to some conclusion.
But understands that, Mr. Reed.
Right. And it's only a test. It's not a permanent change. I don't understand people who oppose this test, this trial, and who say, we don't want to even know. We don't want to know whether expanding the diploma privilege to graduates of law schools outside Wisconsin can work. And the only way you can tell whether it will work or not is to try it, the scientific method. If it works, fine. If it doesn't work, I'll be the first to say, go in another direction.
Right.
But the only way that you can tell whether it works is to try a test.
Thank you.
Finally, I'll wrap up with one point. To me, the bar exam is another of these onerous and unnecessary admission to practice requirements that this court has an opportunity to change and to make people's lives much easier. In the last 3 years since the court changed a number of bar admission requirements here, you changed the proof of practice elsewhere requirement, you instituted a classification of corporate practice, I've gotten a number of emails from people who've thanked me for whatever little part that I had in supporting those changes and who told me their stories and how these changes benefited them. I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I emailed the court when I got an email from the lawyer for the Medical College of Wisconsin who emailed me about how your changes in bar admission rules benefited the Medical College of Wisconsin. Now, who would have thought that a change that making these requirements less onerous would have provided that benefit? When you do a good thing, when you remove all these onerous requirements, that really don't serve any purpose at all except excluding 19 people out of 19,000 practitioners in Wisconsin. There are going to be benefits, there are going to be good things that happen that none of us can even predict. All that this petition is asking is that you try this for a 10-year period to see if it can work. I hope, well, I know that there are speakers here who don't want to even try this test, but I hope that members of the court will be open-minded enough to say, we want to find out if this will work or not. We're not committing to it. If it doesn't work, if it results in more complaints and more claims, fine. Everyone wants to be objective about this. But please don't say no to just a trial. I hope everybody here would be open-minded enough to at least say, we're going to try it because it can result in tremendous benefits for everyone. I would like to reserve a few moments to respond to the bar's and the law school's presentations. But
that's standard. We ask the petitioner wants to respond, so you will do that. I just want to call everyone's attention to the fact that this petition was filed in September of 2009, and it was not taken up in the year 2009 because there was a case pending relating to the diploma privilege. And this petition was held pending that case. When the case was terminated, this petition was put on at the first opportunity to hear it. So that's why it's on September 30th. I'm going to call on, why don't you just stay where you are, Mr. Levine, if that's all right with you. And we'll call on James Bowl, President of the State Bar of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice. My name is Jim Bowl, and I am the President of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and I appear today on behalf of the members of the State Bar of Wisconsin to briefly outline the position of the State Bar Board of Governors regarding the Diploma Privilege Petition. At the most recent Board of Governors meetings, which took place on September 25th, the Board of Governors welcomed Professor Dan Blinka from Marquette University Law School and Dean Kevin Kelly of the University Law School to discuss the petition before you. Past President Levine also submitted written comments to the Board of Governors for review. After a lengthy discussion, the Board of Governors voted 32-6 with two abstentions to adopt the motion affirming the State Bar's continued support for the diploma privilege. For the record, specifically, the Board adopted the following resolution. The State Bar of Wisconsin opposes the petition to amend or repeal SCR 40.03. To that end, the State Bar of Wisconsin recognizes the benefits of teaching of Wisconsin-specific law at the two state law schools, which better prepares graduates for the practice in law in Wisconsin. Accordingly, the State Bar supports continuation of the diploma privilege, which will continue the tradition of ensuring the teaching of Wisconsin law in law schools. In reaching the conclusion, the board members stressed the central importance of including Wisconsin law in the bar exam administered by the BBE and to continue to encourage Wisconsin law schools to focus on teaching Wisconsin law. Members of the board did express concern regarding the petition, regarding the logistical and administrative problems that would result if the BBE were required to track the curricula of scores of law schools around the nation. The Board of Governors, as you can see, vote was not unanimous, and I am the elected member of all members of the State Bar of Wisconsin. So it's duty-bound for me on the record to indicate that the position of the Board of Governors is not reflected uniformly by all the members of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I thank the Court for the time to appear here today to present the Board of Governors' position. I'm happy to answer any questions regarding the position or the discussion that took place at our most recent meeting.
Are there any questions?
I have a question. What is the split on the Board of Governors between those members who have had the diploma privilege and those who have taken and passed the state bar?
Justice Kirks, I can't give you an exact number. That was not a discussion that took place. However, based upon the discussion, I can tell you that anecdotally, I believe that a majority of the Board of Governors members received the benefit of the diploma privilege.
Thank you. Could I ask you, Mr. Bohl, Mr. Levine has submitted a document to us, and there's a statement in that document. At its meeting of August 18, 2010, the State Bar's Board of Bar Examiners Review Committee voted to support the petition. What's that all about?
That is correct. The BBE committee of the State Bar voted to support past President Levine's petition. I can also inform the court that the Young Lawyers Division voted to oppose it and continue to support the Wisconsin Diploma Privilege, and the Senior Lawyer Division was 4-4 split on their board. That is the only groups, sections, divisions, and committees that I'm aware of on behalf of the State Bar who have weighed in on this particular petition.
What is the makeup of the Bar Examiners Review Committee in terms of where they went to law school and who benefited by the diploma privilege?
The makeup as far as the members of that committee?
Yeah.
Actually, past President Levine's on that committee and may be better able to address that particular issue. I'm not sure.
I've had people stop me on the street and tell me that that Wisconsin's getting a bad reputation because of the diploma privilege, and that every other state in the union requires admission through bar exam, and looks like you can slide by here, and that's really bad for all the lawyers in the state. That was an opinion that surprised me, but I've heard it a number of times. What do you think of that? Was that raised at the Board of Governors?
Well, that particular issue was not raised by the Board of Governors. I can indicate to you that when I was a candidate for State Bar President and traveled to over 35 different local bars, this issue was only raised once, if not twice. Since I've had the privilege of serving as President-elect and President, I've attended maybe 3 or 4 outstate meetings of other presidents and President-elects and past presidents, and that issue has never been addressed to me.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Mr. Bohl.
Thank you.
The court is going to quit at noon, so unless I hear from someone who has a 3-minute statement, I'm going to quit now. You have a 3-minute statement. I'm going to really clock you and take you out at 12. And let me just tell you, the court will then recess till 1:30, and the court has a closed conference at 1 p.m. Go ahead.
May it please the court. Thank you. I did intend to be brief, and I also...
Name, please.
Attorney Christopher Weissmiller. As the court mentioned, there was that lawsuit, as the court knows, I was a part of. First, let me say I apologize that lawsuit may have led to that perception in the public that perhaps Wisconsin lawyers have it easy somehow if they were admitted by diploma privilege. Going to law school for 3 years is tough. It's not easy. We've all done it. We all know that it was difficult. We all studied hard. We all worked very hard to get good grades, regardless of where we went. I think that this court and this state and this bar are incredibly enlightened to respect that and to offer the diploma privilege as an option. I would never want to get rid of the diploma privilege. Not what I ever intended to do, not ever what I wanted to do, and I want to make that very clear, and that's why on this petition I joined only in asking that the diploma privilege be extended. That being said, I don't know that anyone here has had the opportunity to watch somebody who has failed the bar exam by 1 point open up the letter telling them that they have failed. I got to tell you, as a husband, it was not enjoyable to watch. And I can tell you that a week ago when my wife was finally sworn in, it feels very, very good to finally have a law partner. That being said, I have no idea why she had to take that bar exam. I studied with her during law school. I know that she studied hard. I know that she did as well as she could, and I know that she received passing grades throughout. There is nothing that she learned, and I'll say this too. She actually attended Marquette as a visiting student for 16 credits and passed those courses. I will say this. It does not make sense to me why she had to take a bar exam where half of it doesn't test Wisconsin law when she even went to Marquette. It doesn't make sense. The Wisconsin bar exam has the multi-state bar exam, which tests common law crimes, not the state law in this state. It also tests joint and several liability, which is not the law in this state, and yet it's required by this court that those being admitted by the bar exam take it. I think that at least the multi-state bar exam needs to go, if not the entire bar exam. I know that, and I thank you very much for hearing from me, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weissmuller. The court is in recess until 1:30, closed conference at 1, and we have approximately 10 people. And if anyone else wishes to speak, would you sign up with the marshal? We are in recess.